Today at Radio Verulam, we are once again speaking to local MP Bim Afolami to get the answers to your questions. We return back to normal after the election, so remember, if you haven't been lucky to get answers from Bim this month, you will be back again soon. As always, I welcome you onto the show, Bim. And I do want to talk about the topic that is in the ether at the moment, especially amongst the MPs that I'm chatting to. It seems to be haircuts. I asked Bambos Charalambos about his. We talked to Daisy Cooper about hers as well. Have you had a post-lockdown trim?
I have. It's not terribly interesting. My hair is now shorter than it was. And that's about as much interest as I've got in my own hair. And I'm sure anyone else has interest in it.
Well, I mean, Bambos had a much more...
Bambos Charalambos has the best name in the House of Commons.
Yes, a lot of people have agreed with that, but he thinks that he didn't have the best hair in the House of Commons, so that's why I kind of bring it up.
Well, he's bald, isn't he?
He's not. He had a hair trim, and he was very disappointed that it was cut short.
I've now slandered him on radio. Sorry, don't sue me for anything. I'm sure you've got a full head of hair. Sorry.
Well, we'll move it on then from hair trim talk, because that's not too worrying to you. But lockdown is lifting a little. This is positive news. And we do have to ask, have you been able to go out with friends, family, enjoy the local scene a little bit more, and also, you know, get involved with local businesses?
In short, yes. So I've been spending as much time as I can going out with friends and all the rest of it. And the weather's getting better as we record this. So I look forward to doing much more of it. The important thing is that the footfall in the town centres is really picking up. So obviously this is listened to for people in Harpenden and around Harpenden, but if you go further north to Hitchin, where I also represent, the footfall's also picking up there. And really, I am optimistic about how things will go the next few months. I'm pretty sure we will do the substantial unlocking on the 21st of June. So I think that things are going to get a lot better very quickly.
Do you feel encouraged and positive that things are getting back more to normal?
In short, yes. I mean, look, once we have covered everybody with two doses, that is the 99% of people who may end up in hospital, then you've done everything you can as a society. We've had the second best vaccination rollout in the country. I think it's fair to say Israel's is probably better than ours, though Israel is a much smaller country. And we've done a good job. And as a country, we've all come together. It's not just the government. It's the pharmaceutical companies. It's the NHS. It's a societal effort. And now it's time to get back to normal and learn to live with this thing that it's around. Because we, you know, once you've vaccinated people, that's all you can do. I don't believe for the people that choose not to have a vaccine and who are vulnerable, I don't believe that the whole society should live in lockdown until, you know, until they decide to get COVID naturally or something else. I think that it's important we have offered everybody the vaccine, and ultimately people, it's their right not to be vaccinated if they don't want to be, but that's also potentially dangerous for some of them. But I think as a society we have to move on, and we've offered everybody the vaccine. I think we should move forward.
So let's move on to a successful month for the Conservatives. May was all about voting, all about casting ballots. And this was also the reason why we couldn't talk to you last month. But the Conservative Party had impressive wins across the country. Why do you think your party found such success?
Well, I think it's important to be proportionate. We had very good results in the north, good results in the Midlands, good results in bits of the south, poorer results in other bits of the south. I put it really down to two fundamental factors. The first, and there's no point me getting away from this, in areas of the country where the Conservative Party has historically been strong, where we've run a lot of the councils for a very long time, we are feeling, you know, people look at us and say, oh, you know, maybe I want to give somebody else a go. A certain percentage of the population will feel that. And I think one has to be honest about that. I'm not saying they're right, but I think it's clearly there. Whereas in other parts of the country, particularly the north, we are new almost. You know, the Labour Party's dominated those seats for such a long time. And so voting Conservative is an act of change in the north, whereas in the south, it's perceived to be an act of status quo. And I think, therefore, that will reflect a certain difference in result. It's my view as well that it's important that the government and the party maintains a balance between the south, the east, the north, and the west, and not to get overweight any of those regions, because the Conservative Party can only win elections when we're a national party, and we can't be too obsessed with one region or another.
I just want to carry on this talk here, because a lot of discussion points have actually been around the opposition as well. Leader Sir Keir Starmer and the lack of the Labour Party's success, some have ascribed that to his party unable to convey a message of ideas or supposed core values. What would you say are the Conservatives' core values, and why have you been successful at telling people these?
Well, Conservative core values are unchanging, but our policies do change to adapt to the times. So our values are about freedom, responsibility, about economic prosperity and progress, and about ensuring that everybody can realize their own potential as an individual throughout their own lives. Now, the problem with Labour, it appears to me, is that I'm not entirely sure what their values are beyond a broad sort of socialist sense of equality. That's sort of, if I were to pin it down, that's what I would probably say. And the difficulty is, when you actually play that out in the modern world, that's actually what the Conservative Party appears to be doing. You know, we are focusing on helping the underprivileged get better education, get better job opportunities, level up the poorest parts of the country. This is the sort of thing that the Labour Party used to say that they were going to do. And we're doing it. And we can do that without going against the rich or against the successful. We can do that as part of a national effort. The Labour Party appears to really have two bits to it. You've got a true Corbynista socialist party, which, you know, is far to the left of most people, but there are considerable numbers of people there, and it's important to be honest about that. And then you've got this weird centre-left, not quite Blairite, but not socialist group, who are indistinguishable from Greens or Lib Dems, as far as I can tell. They're very much Labour. And so the Labour Party, its job, and Keir, who I like and respect, has got a very difficult job, and I wouldn't have his job for any money in the world. He needs to somehow try and unite all the people on the left behind him to say, you know, the Labour Party is by far the biggest beast in the left-wing jungle. Back us, and we can take the fight to the Tories. Unless he can do that, the Labour Party is going to be in some trouble.
I do want to move on to actually an individual triumph for you, though, Bim. I do have to offer congratulations, because you have had confirmation of royal assent of your British Library Board power to borrow bill. How proud were you to get this own bit of legislation passed?
I'm very proud, because it doesn't happen very often. There are very few opportunities that individual members of Parliament put through private business and private members' bills. I managed to do it, and therefore I feel very happy and proud of myself and pat myself on the back. However, it came because, A, it was a relatively minor piece of legislation that helped the British Library expand and grow. And that's really important, because there's hugely important work they do, not just in libraries, but in terms of helping with their business and IP centers, intellectual property centers, help people set up and run and be successful in their own businesses, help poorer regions, British libraries expanding and having satellites in the British Library across the country. Those things are really important to me. They're important, I think, for opportunities of people all over the place. The British Library is not just the building in St. Pancras. So I picked something that I knew was a positive thing that was non-controversial, and I therefore managed to get the government to agree time so that it could go through. And so you've got to pick your battles. And so really, it's a worthwhile piece of legislation that can really make a difference to one of our best British cultural institutions, the British Library. And so I've been very proud to do it. And not many people get to pass their own law. So there we are.
Yeah, does that excite you that almost in the annals of history, Bim Afolabi's name will be now forever attached to the British Library?
It'll be on page one, the British Library Bill. It'll be when people talk about the 2020s, this will be the thing they talk about. Yeah, no. I think that it's important because even in government, and you could be prime minister and passing all sorts of legislation, it's the government's legislation. Right? It's bigger than any individual, whatever it is. Whereas this really is just yours. So there we are.
So continuing with your work, you have been on the Parliamentary Renewable Energy Group. This month, there has been actually a talk about a breakthrough in efforts of British nuclear fusion. We will also talk about the environmental bill in a second, but I do want to focus on this because is the government looking to commit to this type of energy source, which many have described as being integral to the future and giving vital funding that it needs?
So what I know is the previous Cabinet Secretary, Mark Sedwill, now Lord Sedwill, visited the nuclear fusion centre where they were doing some of this work when he was in post. And I know that at the very highest levels of the civil service and government, there is a lot of excitement about this. But I also know that there are a few massive challenges in order to achieve this. Nobody's managed to crack it. There's a professor at Oxford who I know called Ian Shipsey, who's head of physics. And he's been very involved with this. You know, some of the brightest, greatest minds that we have are trying to crack nuclear fusion. And so I hope we manage to do it. It's my view that what government should do is it should back this exploratory work. Because if we back this exploratory work, it doesn't matter if we end up losing money on stuff that doesn't work, small bits of money. Because if you get something that does work, when you get something that does work, the benefits so far outweigh those smaller things that didn't work. And I think government should be ambitious and help people do that, because it's very difficult to get private funding for this because the returns are so uncertain. No banker, you know, I speak as a former one, no banker worth their salt would lend against this sort of thing, because you wouldn't be able to tell when you're going to pay it back, and you wouldn't be able to monetize it or value it. But this is the sort of thing that government should do with its science funding. We're increasing the amount of funding of research and development to 2.4%, I think, by the late 2020s, which is the highest it has ever been. And this is the sort of thing we should be increasing our spend on.
Now, focusing more on the eco-friendly nature of some of the Conservatives' recent actions, you now have the new environmental bill, and you were part of the committee and you welcome the biodiversity targets. But can you explain how in the future a lot of these targets will actually now be legally binding?
Yes. So the Environment Bill is a really, really important piece of legislation. It does a bunch of stuff around biodiversity, air pollution, puts requirements on local authorities and organizations. I suppose in terms of legally binding, it places the 25-year environment plan on a statutory footing. So that means a footing in law. Now, the environmental improvement plans that are going to be put together by this Quango, which I'm not personally involved with Quangos, but there we are, the Office for Environmental Protection, put forward these annual progress reports to Parliament, which will basically say, you know, this is what we're doing on all these aspects of the environment and how we are measuring up to our 25-year environment plan. So it will, what the government is doing is something that governments very rarely do, which is give the opposition and the public a stick to beat it with if it is not achieving its stated goals and putting these things in legislation. I really hope the Prime Minister's thought this one through, because it is very tough. And we are committing to very, very ambitious targets. I'll be very honest with you. I think that the next 5 to 10 years are going to see some very, very, very difficult decisions around how we impact people's lives. And we're going to have to manage that in a way that, that people stay with us and they don't revolt against it. If anybody thinks revolt can't happen, look at the Gilets Jaunes in France, you know, for basically raising petrol fuel duty. So I think that it's going to be very challenging politically. And I say that with a small p, I'm not saying that sort of for the Conservative Party per se, just to manage this process of changing the way we live our lives, but it's important to do it. And we've got to do that in our country so that we can then be a leader in the world with other countries and to say, look, we've done it, you can do it too.
We have talked there about a potential kind of cause for problems for the party in the future, but in the here, in the now, Conservative Party actions have not been without criticism this month. There was the highly controversial introduction of voter IDs at election. In February, when I talked to you here on Radio Verulam, you actually explained that quite often legislation doesn't solve most problems, and that most of the time it's a problem where you're not making sure that the current laws are properly enforced. In 2019, there was one prosecuted offence of voter fraud. Surely this goes against your logic, and I'm not saying that this is the party logic, but your own logic, and this is an over response for a system that actually works fine as it is.
Well, it works fine, it doesn't. It is, if you were to go and you're not in at home, and the Royal Mail comes and tries to deliver something, and it's too big for your letterbox, and they take it back, and you have to find it's extraordinarily annoying, isn't it? And you now have to find, they give you that card, and it's, you know, a sorting office in some industrial estate you've never been to. And then you have to try and find this place and try and get your package. And when you go there, what do they ask you for? They ask you for ID, okay? This is just to pick up, I don't know, an Amazon book or something. Most things in life, we are asked for identification. People aren't too prescriptive around the type of identification, but they will ask us, they will ask you for something. Now, is it completely unreasonable when voting to ask people for a piece of identification? I don't think it is. And so I think that all the people that are sort of talking about impending doom because people are simply being asked for an ID when they vote, I think is way, way over the mark in relation to whether it's necessary or not. Look, you can continue, a lot of things can continue as they were, but where you see potential for infringement or difficulty, you've got to act just as much as where it's already happened. Just because there's only been one prosecution, A, doesn't mean it's the only time it's happened, and B, doesn't mean it couldn't happen more. So I think that it's a perfectly sensible piece of tidying up legislation that's been hugely blown out of proportion by the opponents. And what you've got to ask yourself is, why is it that some people so object to doing what they do when they have to pick up a parcel when they vote? What are they so afraid of?
Well, maybe you could ask the question to Prime Minister Boris Johnson, because he voted 12 times against ID cards. And when debating the issue on social media accounts having to have ID people, the government actually explained that users without ID or users who are reliant on ID from family members would experience a serious restriction of their online experience, freedom of expression and rights. And that was in March of this year. So why has the government's own logic kind of changed on this? And will the government actually facilitate maybe a free form of identification so that people aren't left behind?
Well, you've talked about apples and oranges. An ID card's quite different, because an ID card is something that can be requested on demand by an authority if you were walking down the street. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about you choosing to go and vote and simply verifying who you are. Now, in terms of the government giving everybody a piece of ID, the government already does give people pieces of ID. You can apply, for example, for a driver's provisional driver's license. You don't have to drive. You don't have to pay for driving lessons. You can apply for a license. Most people have passports. There are other forms of ID that will be accepted. And by the way, this is what we already have in Northern Ireland. So voter ID is already used in voting in Northern Ireland. Now, I accept Northern Ireland is a slightly different, often politically, from England, Wales and Scotland. But even in somewhere as hot politically as that, they managed to achieve voter ID without any real difficulty.
In terms of the provisional driver's license, so passport, all these forms of identification, they do cost money. And this is the kind of concern that 3.5 million people would have to fork out of their own pocket now to be able to do that. Would there be any cover of that cost from the government for that?
Well, no more so than people using their ID when they want to go into a pub. People show their ID when they want to pick up a bus, they show their ID. I mean, and there are, you know, various different types. I just don't believe it's a feasible argument that there are no ways of people being able to prove who they are. That just isn't true. And I think everybody listening to this knows it. There is a reasonable argument to say we've got to make sure that the types of ID are as broad as possible. And I think that's very important. But other than that, I just don't think that that's a reasonable argument to ask us that.
Second discussion point. As a graduate in the subject, were you not a little bit insulted by Gavin Williamson describing history as a dead-end course that leaves young people with nothing but debt? Surely
you said that about history particularly?
He described it as arts and humanities subjects, and he wants the focus to be on more science and kind of STEM subjects.
How do I put this? I think Gavin can look after himself, or at least to some degree he can. It's my view that there are a lot of people going to university who end up being disappointed afterwards with what their options appear to be. That's one of the reasons why I work very hard on apprenticeships, because I think that we need more and higher quality apprenticeships across a range of different sectors, not just in the traditional building trade or that sort of thing, across everything, because I think there needs to be more opportunities outside university. And it's also my view that a lot of the skills gaps we have are in sciences rather than the arts and humanities. However, that does not mean that all arts and humanities are useless, clearly. And that also does not mean that people shouldn't study them. But I think people do need to be aware that if they do study certain degrees at certain places, that aren't necessarily going to lead to sort of high paying jobs, they are aware they're taking that sort of risk. And I think that people just need to understand that a bit better, rather than millions of people, not millions, hundreds of thousands of students coming out every year expecting the world to open up to them when they haven't necessarily got the degree that is right for the sort of job that they wanted to have. And I think that reappraisal is needed.
So, in this system, then, do you think that going forward there'll be more information offered for graduates and individuals?
I hope so. I completely hope so. Frankly, I think it's the university sector has grown too big. It is too big. The universities have pursued a model of bums on seats rather than highest quality possible, because that's how we've incentivized them. So I think that's something the government needs to look at and change. We need to somehow get away from this model where bigger university the better, because the job market doesn't work like that. Students from school need to have more options explained to them properly. And not just the students, but the parents. You know, everybody forgets that one of the biggest influences, probably the biggest influence on a young person's life, is their parents or their caregivers, because it's not always parents necessarily. A lot of the parents need to be educated too. They need to understand that little Johnny shouldn't necessarily always go to university. Not always. There are other options for little Johnny. And I think parents also need to be talked to and appreciate those options. Because actually, once explained to them, this is why I do so much work on apprenticeship, once you explain it to parents what the different options are, they think, gosh, this is great. Why didn't I think of this before? My kid could go and work at a great business, then do a degree apprenticeship, which means that they're doing their degree a bit later when they actually will frankly learn more and get more out of it. They do it in their early 20s. They've got a great job, they've got a great future, and they don't have any debt. And a lot of parents, if they understood that, would be backing it. But at the moment, we don't really do that. So I think we need to hugely improve that.
Bringing the attention back to the local issues here. My final question from me before we move on to the discussion from the local community. I like seeing democracy in action here. And on Radio Verulam in February, we talked to you about the pet task force. Tell us how this is going in some way to remove the problems that a lot of owners are facing with thefts of their loved animals.
Yeah, so this is really interesting. And I have to be honest, I didn't know anything about pet theft until the last, you know, couple of months, where lots of people kept writing to me about it. And so I thought I'd go and look it up and figure out what was going on. So in essence, the task force is going to assess evidence to see what factors have contributed to the rising pet theft and to provide remedies to break the cycle. Thieves are sometimes individuals preying on animals that have been left outside shops or in cars, but also very organized criminal gangs who approach victims with smaller dogs, often in pairs or groups, cause a distraction and then make off with the pets. Pets are multiple times more valuable than they used to be. You know, a dog that cost 800 quid in 2018 may now be worth, you know, 3-4 times that. And it's considered sort of easy money for people. And that's why I wrote to the heads of Gumtree and Pets at Home to ask what they're doing to stop their websites being used for criminals to sell on stolen pets. You know, because it is sort of stolen goods, conceptually. And the distress caused to families by pet theft is really heartbreaking, particularly as, you know, pets have become even closer with families as a result of the pandemic. So, you know, hopefully this task force will put an end to it. And really, a lot of this is to put the thieves on notice that people are sort of, we're going to go and get them. And hopefully they will stop doing it.
So continuing over to the local community now with the questions for you. As I said there, that was one instance of democracy in action when we do talk to you, Bim, but we always call for questions for you. And the first one here is from Michael. I think this is quite an interesting one. He says, I have always wondered what it's like being a politician and the talks you have with your family / friends. Are your family political? Do you have friends, family who disagree with your politics?
Good question. Very good question. I would say my parents are reasonably political, and I don't tend to have arguments, but when, you know, occasionally my dad will ring me up and having heard an interview from one of my colleagues and he'll shout, why have you got that idiot on? They're speaking complete nonsense. And I sort of just go, you know, can't we talk about something else? So that will sometimes happen. My little sister is, as far as I regard, far too left-wing for my liking. I've been trying to educate her. Hasn't worked so far, which makes some quite interesting, but she's 23, so I forgive her. So it makes an interesting conversation. In terms of friends, this is really interesting because what does happen is that you end up inhibiting a sort of circle of people who, broadly speaking, share the same political views. And that I have noticed. You know, I was thinking of, it's my wedding anniversary as we speak, and I was looking back through our photos and this photo album we had done at ridiculous expense at the time, the thing that only married couples spend money on, things like these ridiculous wedding albums. They do sort of, you do look at them once a year, I suppose. And I was looking back and looking at the people there, and thinking, actually, and somebody made a joke at the wedding about politics and things, the vast majority of those people, broadly speaking, agree with my political views. And I do think that does happen to people. You end up inhibiting a certain mindset. And that's as, I'm sure that is as true of people on the left and people on the right. I don't think that's a conservative thing. So I think that's how I'd characterize it.
An interesting insight into almost behind the scenes there. Tina has sent in a message saying, I've seen your work to help the White Horse Kimpton. What will we be done for all the great pubs as the futures aren't secure, yet through no action or fault of their own? Also, which establishment is the favourite of yours in our local area?
So, there are two things. The first is just the simple economics of it. So that's why the government's done all the support it has for pubs. Eat Out to Help Out, furlough, business rate relief, reopening grants, discretionary grants that I was quite involved with sorting out. You know, so we have done everything on that perspective. more broadly in terms of community pubs, we have put in a new piece of legislation which enables local communities to bid to take over pubs, which is really important because in so many villages, like in Kimpton, but elsewhere as well, Charlton, the village of Charlton near Hitchin, we see it as well. You see a sort of dilapidated building that's a pub and the owner allows it to run down and then eventually puts it in for planning as a house. And because it's had more value, but the community really wants it as a pub. So we're helping communities do that. And I hope to continue with that locally and nationally. In terms of my own personal favourite, I usually get into trouble when I get asked to say this sort of thing. but I will say that the White Horse in Harpenden is nearest for me. So I do like that.
Ah, okay. I hope you don't get in too much trouble over
there. Yeah,
that
yeah, probably it's fine. I've just lost the legs of every other pub.
Oh, goodness. In terms of it, though, Nigel wanted to ask a question in terms of finance. I'm not sure if he has a small business himself, but he explains that the Financial Times this month explained UK commerce sellers are facing 180 million in additional red tape costs as the EU imposes sweeping added tax reforms on sales from outside the bloc. He explains that one of the points why he voted for Brexit was to reduce red tape and bureaucracy, especially for smaller businesses. What is the government going to do to help this?
It's a very, very good question. The if I recall, and I may have got this wrong, but this is something that the EU is doing to all sales coming from outside the bloc coming into the EU. So it's not just for Britain, but it's for every country trying to sell inside the EU. The EU is really putting its regulatory barriers higher and higher across a huge range of different industries, happening much faster than I thought was going to happen, to be honest. And it shows the extent to which Britain was holding back this impulse when we were inside the EU. Now we've left it, they've gone full tonto. It is difficult because we're outside and they aren't going to treat us specially. The deal we have, the trade agreement we've got with the European Union, does exempt us from various things. But for smaller businesses, this is going to be difficult. I think that there are two things the government needs to do. First of all, it's to reduce the cost for smaller businesses here at home. And that's tax-wise and bureaucracy and regulations. And I'm very, very keen on having smarter regulation rather than layering on sort of pointless regulations on everything, which I think we do far too much of. So that's one thing we can do. And the second one is to be a voice for freer and easier trade in the world, in a world where the European Union seems to want to be wanting to be more protectionist, whilst even the Chinese are liberalizing their economy. And if the Chinese are being more liberal than the European Union, I think the European Union's got to think about it. And if necessary, we need to help our small businesses export more aggressively, financially, as well as sort of rhetorically and diplomatically. So they're the things that I do.
Joe has switched the focus onto sports here. He said, I'm a listener of Verulam Sport, but wanted to know what the government is going to do about the European Super League. So I guess he knows now that it's over, but I guess preventative measures from that ever happening or possibly happening again, Bim.
Well, look, the Super League was a bad idea. And the Prime Minister made it, and the Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, made it very clear that we weren't going to stand for it. However, I think at the same time, we need to be very, very honest and accept that the same people who are saying, oh, it's terrible that all the clubs are getting together in this rich cartel, are often the same fans who loved it when some Middle East potentate buys their club, which means they can buy all the players from anywhere across the world. I think we've got to be honest about that and accept that we've really got to have a think about how football should work. What is the balance between money and community? What is the balance between something being rooted in a town or a city and having a thing, a plaything of global super rich? And we have to have that discussion. It's my view that we should have fan ownership of football clubs. I've always been an advocate of it. I don't know what that percentage should be, maybe 25%, something like that. So that by doing that, we always make sure that fans have a voice in the pub. Because quite often, in my experience, people are quite willing to take reasonable business-like decisions, even though they're fans, as long as they're brought into the conversation and they can have a say. And I think a say from fans is a good discipline for all of these clubs to have, because if the fans agreed with going to a Super League, then I think I'd have maybe a different view. But they weren't even brought into the conversation because they have no rights. So it's my view that we should give the fans a bit more rights. It would also help with things like keeping the cost of football kits down and that sort of thing, which a lot of poorer families really struggle with when their little Johnny, I don't know why I always pick Johnny, I've got nothing against Johnny's, when little Johnny wants the home kit, the away kit, the European kit, and these are really expensive. So those small things can actually have quite a big impact as well.
Moving from Johnny to Ian, Ian asks, you shared two Republican tweets this month and your fellow Conservative MP Simon Clark described the party as the Conservative sister party in the United States. Ian said, though, how can the Conservatives consider the party as any sort of relation in its current toxic state? It is against many of the democratic rights we hold dear here in the UK.
Yes, I think, and this is when one should always be careful with Twitter, it's a very dangerous medium. I think the tweets I shared were around being sad that the Republican caucus got rid of Liz Cheney as their third ranking member for effectively saying that Trump is a bad guy, which I agree with. I think he's a bad guy. And the Republicans, the longer they're stuck in this Trump embrace, the longer they deserve to be locked out of power. And they will see America move to the left as a result, and they will have only themselves to blame. It is because the Republican Party does have a lot of very capable people, people within it who could fit into the Conservative Party, but they also have a bunch of people who are pretty bonkers. I think the Republicans are in a very tough spot at the moment. Fundamentally, that's because they don't have a real view. They do not have really a coherent view of how they want to change America for the good. What they have is they have Donald Trump. And I don't quite know how Trump has managed this, but he appears to have them completely enthralled to him and his whims, a bit like a sort of late medieval aging monarch, which I find incredibly odd. And I think the Republican Party needs to start to get away from him, even though he's left office, he still seems to have this control. Because if they don't, then they're in real trouble.
Marcia has cast her eye onto things over in Germany. She explains Germany are paying reparations for its colonial actions. I think from my own memory, it was Namibia, the country involved. She asks, is this something that the UK government would consider?
I think the answer to that is no, because reparations don't really work. And let me explain why. So let's just say the British government decided it was going to pay reparations to, I don't know, a country in sub-Saharan Africa for the slave trade. The first thing you've got to accept is that people were benefiting on the slave trade. The key word is trade, right? So there are people on both sides of that transaction benefiting. So there were people in various countries in West Africa who were getting a lot of money from this slave trade. And what they were doing is they were, when they win a war or a battle, they'd imprison, take captives, and then sell them off to Europeans. And so I don't quite know how reparations works in that context. And secondly, I fundamentally disagree with the idea that you should hold, it's actually, frankly, a religious but non-Christian idea of somehow holding white British people today, holding them responsible for the sins of 200, 300, 400 years ago, I think it's a very, very odd thing to do. And I think it's completely self-defeating. I say it's religious because it is a sort of quasi-Christian notion of Jesus, you know, dying to save the sins of the whole world. I think it's very, very odd in a modern society to insist that the current taxpayers pay my ancestors in Nigeria for crimes done to them, where frankly, some of my ancestors benefited in Nigeria from this slave trade going on. And by the way, they would admit that entirely. Of course, there are all sorts of people that didn't benefit as well. And I just think it's very, very dangerous. The only way to deal with these sorts of issues is to move forward. Understand, read, understand the history, of course, but move forward. I think reparations is quite a reductive way of thinking about it.
I think when talking about this subject before with me, Bim, you actually talked about Tom Holland's book, Dominion, and you explained how it kind of links into that ideology. Would you recommend Marsha maybe reading that book to get your viewpoint
on this? Dominion is a great book. I'm a Tom Holland groupie. he actually has this wonderful podcast called The Rest is History. He does it with this other historian called Dominic Sandbrook, and it's really wonderful, incredibly thoughtful. I learn a huge amount. So I'd urge you to read that and to listen to the podcast.
Moving it on to the final few questions here, and these are actually more to do with the area. Mark, a different Mark to another one that has asked a question here, Mark with a C, says he likes that you're highlighting the lack of safety on Redbourne Road, but actions speak louder than words. What is actually going to be done, Bim?
What's going to be done is working with the county council, who are responsible for the roads. I mean, it's worth me saying, you know, I don't have executive authority over the roads. I wish I did, but I don't. So really, it's me persuading the county council. The local county councillor, Annie Brewster, is fantastic. She's one of the best people in local government I've ever come across. She really cares about her residents and understands how to get things done. I'm working very closely with her and others to make sure that we actually reduce the speed at key points and improve the safety. That's all I can say, but I would also say that the last days of the survey for the Redbourne Road are this weekend, so please contribute. And the evidence will be part of the evidence considered in the feasibility study we're doing now around what we need to do to improve safety on that road. There has to be a process. I know it's frustrating because look, I've got, you know, the autocrat within me. I would just love to march on the road and say, right, we're going to do this. In fact, I did do that until I was told that I could do it. So I completely understand how boring and just frustrating this process can be. But the reason why the process is there is to stop any individual just going on and randomly deciding things that may or may not be wise. We have to go through this process. I'm pretty sure the council's committed to it and we'll get it done. But go and do the survey. If you want any, if you can't find it or whatever, get in touch with my office and we'll help you.
We will put the survey link as well into our description of this video because it will be going out before. So make sure if you do have an opinion on it to get that done before this weekend. In terms of area issues, Sarah has asked about Hitchin and Harpenden's town centre with COVID restrictions to remain until residents decide on the long-term future of it. She's asked, what is your opinion on it? What do you think should happen there?
I find this very difficult. My instinct tells me that the focus should be on what the businesses want and need. And if the businesses that are affected by road closures want the road things to go back to how they were, I would need a pretty good reason to not return them to how they were. But if the businesses seem to think that it's better for them the way it is now, then in which case we should lean on them. We should agree with them in that sense. But I think the focus for me is what's best for the businesses. Keep the footfall up, keep people spending in our town centres.
So to finish, it is Euro 2021 fastly approaching. We did have a question there from a Verulam Sport listener, but we do know from talking to you that you are a big football and Arsenal fan. Soon many of the games will be on TV and the final is actually here in the UK. Will you try and attend, or if not, how will you be watching the Three Lions play?
I will try and attend because I will basically, if there's a reshuffle before, I will try and become sports minister. I'm largely for the reason that I can attend. But if not, I will be badgering everybody I can think of to try and get to the match. these efforts are going to be unsuccessful, in which case I'll be watching them on telly like everybody else. I mean, I'm just so excited to have it. I mean, I really, really miss this big international tournament. We lost it last year. I think England this year, we really have a good side. I'm feeling very, very good about it. We really are. We're good to go. I'm not convinced any of the other teams are that great this year. So I think we've got a good chance.
And in terms of it, we do have to ask this. Do you have a favourite England song?
Well, the one that I love was Euro 96, the song then.
It's Coming Home.
It's Coming Home. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was when I was 10. And that really was, I mean, that was such a special tournament. I remember everything about it. I remember the games. I remember the celebration of the dentist chair drinking game that Gazza and Teddy Sheringham did. The stories, you know, of that England team. So, no, that is very much my favourite one.
Well, thank you for your time today, Bim. Hopefully next time when we chat to you, there'll be good news about England. And as always,
and always
to everybody, do send in your questions to my email at Radio Verulam. But as always, we hope you stay well over the next month when we chat to you soon, Bim.
Thank you.